Welcome to How to Kill a Lion, the braingasms, anxiety, and creative chaos behind the biggest ideas in advertising, and how they won a big, shiny, con lion.
I think it's pronounced can.
Okay.
Like can of whoop-ass or soup or something.
And how they won a big, shiny, cans lion.
Nope. No S. Can.
But really? Are you sure?
Well, no one's really sure, but some awesome old French dude in a tiny Speedo called it that. And he was born there, so that's what we're going with.
All right, got it. Punching in. And how they won a giant f***ing can lion.
Nailed it!
Get on the roof and hold on tight.
Why don't you try reading the rules, Shankopotamus?
It's tight, Ed.
Don't have a grandson with a dog collar.
This is How to Kill a Lion with Jordan Buntain.
Bonjour, comment ça va? Bienvenue à How to Kill a Lion. Okay. My French is terrible, but this year, I don't have to learn French, sadly, because as you may already know, the 2020 Cannes Lion Festival has been killed already. Cancelled. Zilch, nada, done, shut down, beaucoup de merde, it is not happening. It's really sad, I know I'm upset about it, but had there been no global pandemic this week, the best in the advertising industry would be in the south of France right now, celebrating the best ideas in marketing and advertising in the world. It has now been pushed to next year, same time, third week in June, 2021. So, this year we won't get to drink rosé on the patio of the Carlton and watch Burger King's Moldy Whopper and the tampon book from the female company duke it out, which is, let's be honest, this is really sad. As you know, the people who worked on both of these campaigns and all the entries this year, let's be honest, they deserve a ton of high fives, because doing amazing work is really difficult. It takes giant leaps of faith from both agency and client, so for them not to get their moment of glory in the French sun, it really sucks. I know we'll do it again next year, but because it's not happening this year, it just feels like we're putting it off. But you can look at this with sadness. You can go and get a case of 1776, which is French beer. You can drink them all and cry into your croque-monsieur. Or you can look at this as an opportunity. So if you're an agency or a client, starting today, yes, today, you have 1 year to make the best damn work you've ever made in your life. You have 365 days to stop making shitty ideas and invest in creativity. Have a goal to maybe even win a lion. Try to get on next year's shortlist. Screw it, you know what? Win big. Try and win a gold. But at least let's learn all about the Cannes Lions and figure it out. And guess what? By listening to today's podcast, you'll be well on your way, as today, I'm with a gentleman by the name of Per Pedersen, who has been given the nickname Mr. Can. He was Grey Global's creative chairman, and his job was, literally, it was to make every outlet of Grey's global network Can Lion worthy. And I'd say he did a pretty good job, as for years, you know, Grey was one of these agencies that nobody wanted to work at. Like, it literally was a place that was grey. It wasn't black, it wasn't white, it wasn't good, it wasn't bad, it was just meh. Nobody wanted to work there. But from about starting around 2008, they changed everything up and started to gain some momentum, and by 2014 and through pretty much about 2016-2017, Grey, the global network, was one of the top winning lion agencies in the entire world. And today, we're going to be talking about Per's favorite can winning ideas, the best case studies, and most importantly, how do you win a damn can lion? So he's going to tell us what to do and definitely what not to do. So if you actually want to learn how to kill a lion, this is a must listen. Okay, let's do it. Ex-chief global deputy head creative Mac Daddy. I don't even remember his title because he had so many of them. But to me, Per Pedersen will always be Mr. Can. All right, here we go. All right. So, Per, how do I put this? So you were the ex-global creative chairman at Grey Group. And I that's great and all. Your titles are fantastic. You've had many there, but I want to just call you Mr. Can.
Yeah, you can do that. I mean, it happened. Lions happened. It was not.
I know they. Well, they happened for a reason. I think, you know, and not only that, like, you were able. So Per's job, if no one knows who Per Pedersen is, and you've been living under a rock, he was the guy at Grey who helped turn this dinosaur around with Tor Mieren. Obviously, there were a lot of other people involved at the time when we were winning a lot. There was Ari and Steve. There were the Robs. There was Jeff and Leo, Lisa and Derek, Doug and Steve. There were so many people that were doing it, but you two were kind of the guy
guys who helped turn it around. And you were doing it globally too. So you were going office to office to office to try and just make the creative better. So whether that was showing them how to do a case study right, how to make an idea better, how to start and make a better idea. That was your job essentially, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I mean, so, that was how Tor and I split it up. You know, we both brought something to the table, and the combination turned out to be pretty strong. And again, I mean, we were not probably not meant to be a team, but we were. And first in New York, you know, where I think the big dinosaur was really Grey New York at the time. You know, it was so hard to change the culture of a place that had been around for almost 100 years with no real peak of creativity in those 100 years. There was a lot of bad muscle memory. So that it took a couple of years. But you mentioned a lot of names in your roundup, and I think the stars aligned, and all these good people all you know, decided, you know, let's change this. Let's show the world what we can do as a team. So I think it was not Tor or me or Ari or, you know, it was a team of a lot of very, very talented people that happened to work at the same place at the same time. And you can see also afterwards, all these people, as they left Grey, have gone on to very successful careers and done amazing work wherever they ended up. So I think that was the case. And a little bit the same happened globally afterwards. You know, a lot of talented people were at the same time working at Grey around the world. You know, we unleashed all of that energy and put it into some sort of system and gave it a certain global character or like a way of working and thinking. And it turned out to be extremely successful. But it's I think the days are over when you can name one person or a few people responsible for doing stuff like that. It is really the age of the collective and the team effort, and that's as a Scandinavian person, I'm a profound believer in all of that. You know, so I would never take the glory from someone, or you know, I'm a believer in what we are ultimately doing is a team sport. You know, and if you bring your ego too much into a team sport, the team will break down. You might be the best player on the field, but the team will lose. And I think that's the same in our business.
I think with everyone staying home and watching The Last Dance, the Chicago Bulls thing, they see how great Michael Jordan was. But then when you see all the different players he had around him, that's the only reason he's got 6 rings.
Exactly. I mean, listen, I mean, there will always be a Messi on the Barcelona team or mm-hmm. Jordan, of course. And the media and the surroundings we love our heroes, and I think it's in our culture and it's an important role to have, but I do think that in sports and in advertising and everything where you cannot do it on yourself on your own, you have to be a team player at the end of the day. I mean, that is the most important thing. And I think Tor was a great team player. I tried to do my best. And a lot of the people at Grey at the time were really great team players. So we did it together and succeeded.
Yeah. It was great. I think one of my favorite parts too, which is I always talk about on this podcast about saying to yourself, what is the exact opposite of that? So like, you know, when you're looking at something that seems obvious. But so one thing for me that made me laugh was, of course, you know, when Michael Houston and Tor were came together under Jim Heacon, and the first thing they would ask people is, would you like to come work at Grey? And if they said, oh God, no, I would never work at Grey, they went, you're perfect. You're hired.
But I think that sums it up really, you know, the beginnings were literally like that.
To
convince anybody to go to Grey at the time was pretty hard. And not just in New York, it was basically around the world. It took maybe 5 years to turn that around globally, that, you know, where you started to get the right people, you know, to join, not just as leaders, but also the creatives and the strategists and all that stuff. So, yeah, I mean, it takes a while, you know, but yeah, it was a massive turnaround and also an unlikely one. I mean, I think for the kids listening to this podcast, they might not know the history, but Grey had never succeeded in any way as a creative agency before this. And when Tor turned up, as a creative leader, as he, and it turned out to be this maverick. It was the most unexpected thing that probably ever happened in our industry ever. I mean, mm-hmm. it was the most unlikely network to ever, you know, present itself in Cannes with 100 lions, because that was the, that was like, that, you know, you would say this could not even happen in your wildest fantasy. It wouldn't even happen. So, mm-hmm. and it did, you know, and Tor was definitely instrumental in that. And I think we had a great collaboration in turning things around. Yeah.
I think the big thing for me too is that turning a dinosaur around is different from creating a great startup, because of course you've got all this putty that's old and dying and it's hard to move around. So it has this legacy that you have to deal with. But
yeah.
of course, you know, I think you guys were the first to do it. And now we're seeing success, you know. I think that gave people confidence. That's why you have a Rob Riley able to you know, to really turn McCann back into this amazing big agency, where a lot of the smaller ones, your Drogas, I mean, Wyden's always going to be Wyden, you know, but then you've got your, you know, David Droga had to start his own thing. You know, I'm really sad to, of course, see Barton Graf go away, you know, you know, those for me is like turning the dinosaur around and then also doing some of your best work with your biggest client. That to me is the most impressive part. Like, obviously, you know, the pro bono stuff that we did was great and all, but it's still pro bono. Went to see the work being done on, say, Gillette, you know, which is one of the biggest ad accounts in the world, to do great work and to win at Cannes. That for me is the huge success. So I thought that was incredible.
Totally. I mean, it doesn't happen without that philosophy, really. It doesn't. I mean, I think you can do stuff. You can show the way by picking pro bono work as a way to sort of as a way to teach your organization a way of thinking. But you cannot build creative legacy on pro bono work. I don't believe in that, and I don't think you can build any creative legacy on simply just winning a lot of awards. I think you need to show you know, the hard way, you know, winning with real work that is out there with your real clients, your biggest clients. And it's just so much harder. It's like incredibly more difficult when you're dealing with real money and real issues, real decision making in real complex organizations than
real fear.
Yeah, real fear. I mean, and sometimes really just justified fear, you know, because these are people that can lose everything on a wrong move. And you're presenting these bold ideas to them and you're expecting them to go with it just because it's great. And it's just such a hard, it's just a hard process. So those are the people that I respect. And I think those agencies that have done that are the ones that are not just counting their lions, but also can say, okay, we build a creative legacy, a credibility as a creative force. You mentioned Droga, I think is a good example. I think what Rob Riley is doing at McCann is incredible. And these guys, I mean, again, Greg Hahn at BBDO when he was still there. I mean, these were people that have turned around something that was incredibly difficult with real work. And then you see it being spiced up by proactive work. And I think that is the right combination. You know, you need to have a foot in culture where you become relevant, culturally relevant, by doing stuff that is happening right now. You know, just like the issues that are going on in the US right now and before that with COVID. If you just ignore those things, or gun violence, or the opioid addiction, I mean, if you just ignore those things around you, I don't think you are believable as a creative force. And it might be completely impossible to get clients behind, let's say, gun control campaigns, because it's just too polarizing for most clients. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't do it. I think you should definitely do it. And if you have that combination, you know, be relevant in the time we live in, and try to take that philosophy into your clients bit by bit, I think you are onto something pretty successful. And then you have an agency that is credible and with a culture that people want to be part of.
You know? Absolutely. I think what's cool is we'll come back to the cultural nitro stuff. I've used that phrase a few times. I know when I was talking with Lee Einhorn from he used to be at Venable Bell and Partners, and they did the REI opt outside campaign. So that was cultural nitro. But we'll get into that in a little bit. But I want and this one, what's funny about this podcast, this is a little different in format in comparison to the other ones. The other ones, we were talking about one specific idea, and then we would go into the person's creative process themselves a bit. But in this one, I've got Mr. Can. So you know what? This is How to Kill a Lion. So I'm going to ask you a bunch of, questions. We're going to go over like a little bit of an agenda. So we're going to talk, I want to talk a bit about Can itself. Then like, and this specific season one is about the titanium category. And then the next one, I think we're going to go into a bit more of the sort of standout Grand Prix, or maybe we'll focus on weird ones, but I want to talk a bit about what you thought, what titanium is all about. So people have a context of what this season is about. Then also obviously, what are your favorite five ideas that you remember? And then let's talk about sort of a couple quick things, which is not quick, but the key components to like killing a lion. So we'll get, maybe talk a little bit about case study, cultural nitro, I think is probably part of that conversation. And then also, let's talk a bit about your creative process too, because I'm always looking for kids and, I don't think you ever stop learning. So anything that someone can give you, that says, oh, by the way, I use classical music because it does this to my brain. Who knows? It's just always a nice little trip.
I don't.
I always see you as Scandinavian grindcore.
Well, that, I think that actually works better,
I can see that. It helps you break shit.
Yeah, I know. It's more the mood you want to get into. Yeah,
exactly. True. All right. Well, let's get into it. So let's talk about Can itself. So that what are the top things that you love about Can? And then give me like the top three things that you hate about it. Just, give me highs and lows. Yeah.
I mean, Can this year is in a very difficult position, and I think we cannot ignore that. I mean, this is not a good year for Can. This is the first year Can was canceled, and I mean, they've been through financial crisis where they almost got canceled, but still had a festival. I was there, by the way, that year, and it was like the most depressing festival I've ever attended in my life. It was like nobody there. The weather was bad. It was as if everything was just shit, and there was
even
no
the weather just was like screwing you.
Yeah, it was like some sort of storm that hit the sea. So it was just unpleasant. But they still did it because it has that sort of impact in everything that we do as an industry. I mean, just I think every industry needs a Can somehow. I think you need a place where people get together and celebrate the best work, where you create your heroes and you set a high standard, maybe the highest in of all festivals. At least that used to be like that. It's a wonky one right now, but it's still incredibly hard and difficult to win because it's still the biggest festival with the most entries and stuff like that. I think the role here is beyond the awards. I think the awards are part of the ecosystem of making a creative industry relevant for the world. I mean, sort of transcend into culture, transcend into, the world that we're living in, into business, into the issues, into marketing, or whatever it is that you're into. And Cannes is really the place where that happens, because you have the combination of great work, great people, and everybody is at the same place at the same time. So that part is unique for that festival. It's not, there's probably harder awards to win. I mean, I would say DNAD, a black pencil at DNAD is probably harder than anything in the world to win. But Cannes has more elements, including the people part. I mean, you have everybody, that has some sort of influence on our industry. It's basically there with the clients and the media and everybody. So that is probably the most important part of it. It's a show. It's a place where you showcase great work. It's a place where you can inspire massive changes in the way the industry thinks. And that's why, when we talk about gender equality in our industry, when we talk about diversity of more colors, more Hispanic, more Afro-American in our industry, Can has an important role to play in getting there, and that's basically what I really love about that place. You know, that we need a place that can make the change. You know,
yeah, there's a lot of camaraderie for, you know, it's the togetherness, it's the being jealous of each other, seeing the best work, and then also, just also probably, you know, sharing in some heartache over a drink every so often, seeing that somebody in Japan is going through the same garbage that you do some days too, when you're feeling down. I think that's kind of refreshing, you know?
Yeah. No, I think it changed from being a party, you know, where you would go to bars and parties and that kind of thing. I think it changed from that to become something much bigger and more important. It's still there. I mean, there are still some suckers out there that rent a boat and show off how big they are and how important they are. But I think it falls flat compared to the ones that bring content that is relevant. I think it falls flat compared to the people that engage and inspire and share their knowledge and really show that they care for the industry. Instead of bringing a celebrity to Cannes, they bring their own people to Cannes. I mean, stuff like that. That is definitely the way things are moving. So away from the glamour, away from a few rich people getting richer, to becoming much more a place where you can actually, you know, see that this is an industry that is getting more grown up, you know, and more sincere about what we're doing. So I applaud that, and I think we will all miss Cannes this year for sure. You know, not just because somebody didn't win their Lions. Of course, that's a shame, but we will miss that impact that it has on the real issues for the industry. That is what I think is going to be missed this year. So it's a sad year, not just for Cannes, but I think a little bit also for everyone around Cannes. And I the whole idea about being Mr. Cannes, you know, I think it comes with winning a lot of Lions, but I don't see myself as somebody that has been focused on that part. I really don't. I mean, it happened, and I think, yeah, I've been fortunate enough to have a big collection of Lions, but I can tell you every single one of them was very, very hard work, and nothing comes easy. And it was not for the, you know, let's win a lot of Lions. I never thought about it like that. It was always, let's do this because it's great, you know?
Yeah, then, I think that's the one thing I've noticed throughout all of this is that, you know, I mean, the Lions are the byproduct of great work.
Exactly.
So I'm never too shocked about that one. I guess for me now, like when I want to talk about things that we hate, like for me, I'll give you one that I have. It's like, I think there are too many awards now. So there's just so many. So as you say, it's easier to get one. So it kind of sucks for people who, like, you know, work their asses off to get a bronze. And then it seems like no one cares. You know, and it's like, that's not the case. To get a short list is literally impossible because, you know, you're dealing with so many entries and it's global. It's the biggest global, you know, thing around. So, you know, that's one thing that I hate. I've just seen the awards become so many. So therefore, the diminished, it's like going to see a baseball game versus a football game.
Yeah, true. I think there is that element. Although, again, being global as I am, I'm telling you that bronze lion, if you win that on in the Philippines or in Bangladesh or other places where you don't have the same history of winning hundreds of awards for your country, then a bronze lion is the biggest thing that you ever won in your life.
Right.
And I you know, the celebrations around that from agencies that somehow broke through in the toughest competition with the biggest agencies is really gratifying to see. There's a cynicism, and I think the cynicism comes with the competitiveness of the festival and the fact that it has become more of a you have to win in Cannes it becomes part of your job to win in Cannes. And it becomes part of the expectations that you as a network will compete with other networks and win not just a few Lions, but maybe 100 or 50 or 70 Lions or something like that. And then it just becomes like, who cares about a bronze? Because we want 20 Lions for this idea, and we want golds and, titaniums and all that kind of stuff. That, I think, is is a cynicism where I think people miss the point about why are we doing this and what is it, you know? I think we should, every lion for the team that made this idea and made it all that way, won in one of the biggest competitions that you can win in our industry. A bronze lion is amazing. It is amazing. And I think it's it can be the biggest thing ever, you know? The first bronze lion I won was a bronze lion. And I was so happy.
Mine too.
It took me many years.
I was ecstatic. I lost my mind. I was super excited. I've been watching the festival since I was literally 14 years old. So to actually have it in my hand was a huge moment for me. Yeah.
Exactly. And I keep saying, you know, that first bronze lion was probably the most important one I ever won. So you can't really measure this in, you know, of course, at some point you go like, oh, let's have a titanium because that's very difficult to win. But you know, I think you cannot turn it into a competition. You have to see it as the culmination of a process you went through as a creative. And if you win a lion, any lion, you succeeded. I hate the feeling of disappointment if you, oh, we only won a bronze or a few shortlists. I think that's I've had that feeling, you know, because you this happens, you know, you build up expectations and disappointment follows, not winning, of course. But it's really not fair to think like that, you know.
You have to recalibrate yourself. Yeah, I know once the awards start rolling in, you can't let the top one be your next goal again. It needs to be to even show up, you know, is the win. To be there, to be a part of it, to even be even on the short list is a huge deal.
Exactly. And I think the when people burn out in our industry and they burn out fast, some people burn out faster than they should, actually. I think it has to do with the competitiveness becomes too intense. We're competing in the pitch, we're competing at the agency for our positions, we're competing, you know, to become leaders, we're competing in Cannes. It's a constant competition. I think it wears people out. And if you let that take over from being just a good creative and then doing your best work, then I think you will burn out faster and you will leave this industry way too early. So at some point you have to come to terms with, you know, that you cannot always walk on stage every year and win gold lions or, you know, that's not how it works. You know, there will be ups and downs and there will be, you know, but if you keep trying and if you find the happiness in doing great work, you will probably win more than most people. And you will stay in the industry for longer, right? And I think, you know, in this, when we talk, you know, gender equality and we talk about diversity, and I think there are certain people in our industry that has made it basically a venue for successful white guys. And I hate to bring that up, but I think that is a very fair observation when you look at the key players in our industry and the ones that constantly take glory and are, you know, called out as heroes, they are basically, you know, successful white guys. And I think that is a shame. You know, I really think. And I think that comes with this competitiveness that probably, you know, is making it harder for other people to succeed. The minute you start to deal with winners and losers, and I think we're onto a wrong, it's a wrong way of thinking about what we're doing, you know?
Yeah, I could see that. There's an emotional part of advertising that young people don't realize is coming. And that's definitely the competitive part. It's the frustration. You have to expect that 99% of your ideas are going to die.
Exactly.
One might get through and then you actually get to execution. And it's probably not going to turn out the way you wanted it to. So there's a lot of concessions over and over again. But then, Yeah, I think it's really interesting to sort of look at it as the burnout factor is coming. So you need to just sort of prepare yourself almost emotionally for it. I don't think, for me, I know, and this is just an observation, is that I think that there is a breakdown. I see it in tech companies. They're good at it. They have a good structure where like one guy will be in charge of seven people. And so he or she can actually look at those seven people and sort of, you know, take their temperature all the time and just be on top of them. So he can be a force multiplier for them so that they're not, you know, running on, you know, a broken wheel or something like that. Whereas like, I know I was at one agency where, you know, 75 people reported to one person, the executive creative director, which is just useless at the end of the day, you know, at least from an emotional standpoint. I think that's probably, you know, something that has to be addressed for it to, you know, for things to change. I also don't think the next generation is going to, you know, they've got more options with the tech companies going to Google, going to, you know, all these different places. So I just think they're going to bail on agencies. The talent's not going to go there if they're not, you know, someone's not taking them aside and like just saying, hey, I know you didn't get that monkey in that ad, but are you okay?
Yeah, you know, I think so simple. I think you're right. And I think we can learn a lot from other industries on how to do that, how to deal with people. I think we suck at dealing with people. And I think we, you know, as an industry, we have made it extremely hard to be happy in advertising or creativity. I hate to say advertising because it makes it sound old fashioned. You know, right. because I mean, who's an ad agency anymore? I mean, everybody is a creative agency. But it has become very hard to be happy. And I think that is a shame. And I think done in the right way, awards are part of being happy. But done in the wrong way, where it becomes sort of, you know, like a KPI and your bonuses, you know, that kind of stuff, then it leads to misery. And I think there has been a lot of misery around Cannes and other award shows because you deal with failure and success. And that gap has increased as especially Cannes has grown into importance compared to what it used to be. And that is, I don't think necessarily a healthy development for the industry.
One thing that I think is kind of funny has popped into my head now. I know Microsoft goes and does You Rate Your Boss, right? Yeah. Like, so their you know, compensation part of it is based on also sort of a reverse, you know, you actually rating them. I've never seen it in advertising. Whereas like it's kind of funny, you know, like for you, I'm sure also your job. So now that you see it now, your job was a KPI, how many Cannes Lions you're bringing home. Because of course, at some point, I mean, yes and no, at some point they're going to be like, you know, if we brought home nothing, they'd be like, why are we paying Pear so much money?
I think they asked that anyway. So
fair enough. But like you're like not only Mr. Cannes, but you're like Mr. Happy. So like anytime you're around Pear, you're always happy. So like I easily would make up the compensation for the joy that you brought to the job versus the, you know, actually bringing home the hardware.
I made up my mind to be happy at some point, and I think there is so much joy in what we're doing. If people find the true meaning of creativity and what we can do when we communicate, whether it's for a brand or an NGO or we're dealing with tough topics in society or trying to sell a new product or whatever it is, I think there is extreme joy in that. And I think in the right way, competition, awards, internal competitions and stuff like that can be extremely gratifying and bring a lot of happiness and camaraderie and feeling of you know, more than just having a job. And I always saw it like that. But it is a balance because there is the dark side of it is, of course, wanting more. I only want that many Lions, or why didn't we succeed? And what about our ranking? And you start to, you know, you become obsessed with stuff.
Gollum.
Yeah, it becomes. I think Gollum is there is people like Gollum in our industry. I have met them. I have met Gollum several times in advertising, and they just take it too seriously, and you know, and that's where you see the dark side is how can I influence the jury room in a negative way to make sure that my competitor is eliminated. You know, stuff like that, where you start to think very politically about it, where you start to think very tactical about it. I see no shame in, and I'm proud to say, I will, if we have a great idea on the table, it's everybody's duty to present that idea in the best possible way that it could ever be presented. And maybe that's even half of winning a lion, is actually presenting your idea in the best possible way. It's a little bit like, and I know you and I have worked on this together with success. Actually, we won a titanium together. Mm-hmm. But one of the reasons why we won a titanium is because we almost thought about, here's a great idea, nobody understands it. in the fucking world. I mean, nobody's going to understand. Nobody will ever understand this idea. It's like, it's talked about 401ks and it's complicated.
I still remember telling you the idea and saying, yes, well, it's called 401k. And of course, you know, you look at Ken through the global lens and then you say, no, not global. No. And you walked away. I was like, yeah, he'll come around. It's a great idea. But I'm like, no, he's right. No one in Japan is going to understand what in God's name we're talking about.
So you have that gap immediately. And So it was our job as creatives to say, okay, we cannot stop just by, you know, here's a great idea. We have to do a campaign for the idea, which is then, you can say it's a case video, the PR and all that stuff. And that's, I you know, I'm proud of campaigning ideas. I find that totally legit. And that is the part of having ideas is that to make sure people know they exist. But when you, if you go beyond that and start to say, okay, how can I stack the deck so that I will make sure that my competitor is not winning? How can I influence the juries in a negative way so that I'm sure that they will vote my immediate competitor down so that my chances are increased? Stuff like that. When that happens, then I think people got obsessed about winning, and then I think Gollum shows his face. And I've seen Gollum, as I said, I've seen Gollum in jury rooms. Right. I've seen Gollum pulling strings behind the scenes very many times. And it's that is a negative aspect of what we're doing, and it doesn't bring any joy. Gollum was never happy. He died very unhappy. He had a short moment just before he got burned, you know. Right. But that was about it.
Exactly. Clarity right before it all came down. Yeah, that's
exactly,
true.
Exactly.
That's the sadness.
Because that is the Icarus syndrome. You know, it is. It doesn't bring anything but disaster. And and I think if you start to become obsessed with that, whether you are a sports person, you know, a super athlete that wants to win again and again and again and again, you start to cheat. You start to take doping. You start to cheat or pay people off or whatever. And that's Gollum. That's the obsession of stuff. And that is not you won't hear people like that laugh very often. They will cry more than laugh. And I like to laugh. You know, I think what we're doing is it releases endorphins at a level that is close to SEX.
I want to talk about sort of case study. I want to talk about the core idea, just how to get there. You know, like, what do you think, like, the top, you know, the three main ingredients to winning one? Like, you know, I want to say, of course, the work has to be great. It does. But if the work is going to be great, is there like a place maybe to start from for the work to be great? Like, what have you seen? Tell me all, Mr. Can. Gimme.
That's a tough one.
I mean, it's a lot there.
That was like a really big question. But I do think that you have to step, you know, all the way back to the beginning of what it takes, and there is no great idea. You know, there's never been a lion given to something that was not a great idea. You know, you can have an opinion about any idea that wins, but if it's not a great idea at some level, it will not win. So that's where you really have to start. And what defines that? I mean, God knows. I've always seen it as a moving target, and let's start there. The worst thing you can do is to start to look for what won before. The only thing that gives you from a navigational point of view is where not to go. I mean, if you do something that looks a little bit like WhatsApp, or a little bit like The Fearless Girl, or a little bit like Dumb Ways to Die, or a little bit like whatever is a big campaign out there, Whopper Detour, then you are sure not to win anything. So But I do think it's important that you sort of know your way around all that, and that you spend a lot of time looking at past winners, not to figure out how to copy them, but basically to figure out what you cannot do, you know. Mm-hmm. And it takes one fraction of similarity with an idea that people know already. If people see one fraction of a similarity with an idea that has already been rewarded, it's dead. That idea is removed from competition immediately. The jury will kill it immediately as something that has been seen before, done before. And that's the those are the easy ones. Remember, every jury has to judge sometimes thousands of ideas, and they're basically not looking for reasons to award anything. They're in the first few days, they're looking for reasons to kill, you know. Right. And if you present a reason to kill, and the most common one is, I've seen it before. Didn't somebody do that sort of kind of, then it's dead immediately.
Right.
I mean, it doesn't matter how successful it was. It doesn't matter. It's dead. It's stone dead. So that part is incredibly important. So you have to read up on Cannes. If you're a young person, you have to go to the archives. If you stayed away from Cannes for 5 years, you're lost. You cannot pretend that it's like what it always were before, because it changes all the time, and it changes within the year. It changes. I can only imagine the nightmare it must be for the juries next year to look at ideas pre-COVID, during COVID, during Black Lives Matter, and God knows what 2020 is going to hit us with next, and figuring out how does Moldy Burger stack up to Nike's Black Lives Matter campaign. How does that, I mean, what is more important? You know, that's complicated stuff.
Just changing culturally so fast, yeah, that just feeling the power of each one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think my best advice is to be, know your past, but create in the now. And when I say now, I mean really, really, you know, even if you sell a product, make it relevant for the moment it is released into the world, so that there is that cultural ambition built into any idea, that there is this relevancy in the world that is beyond what this product does, that it reflects the time it's been made in, that it can only happen in this particular moment. That is important. So in a way, we read the times, and I think all good creatives are really good at reading the time they live in, and figuring out how to turn the conversations into something meaningful creatively. And this is not the same as saying every campaign should be Vogue, dealing with the important issues all the time. Mm-hmm. But I guarantee every single idea is influenced by the conversations that are going on. Whether you can see it in the ideas or not, you need to be influenced by what's going on. You have to be influenced by what is going on. And we have to be relevant and not just passively reflect times. I think that the biggest ideas are the ones that are impacting the time that they live in. And that's why you see, you know, the most awarded campaigns in history all have that impactfulness to them, that they are beyond just a short-term piece of advertising. They actually made a big change in the way you think, about a brand, or the way you think about an issue, and maybe it even changed your own behavior to a certain degree. And when that happens, you are sure to win something. You know, if you have half of the jury say this actually changed my mind about something, about a brand or an issue. It was enlightening me. It made me think twice about certain things, or I can actually say that I, you know, my habits just changed because of this. Then you are sure to win guaranteed. So great idea, impact, and then I am a believer in craft. Call me old fashioned, but I do think that you can throw it all away if you don't execute it in with the right, you know, the right craft for storytelling, emotional engagement, humor, sadness, whatever it is, if it feels bland or you know, not you know, really doing justice to the idea, you know, and this can be design or copywriting or filmmaking or editing or whatever it is, then you probably will lose anyway. You know, so it's a lot of things. You know, it's mm-hmm. There's a million pitfalls. But you know, the people that get all of these things right have a chance. There's no guarantees, but they have a chance.
I've even seen, though, it was funny too, is that great ideas, sometimes you see the case study video and you're like, oh, like it just, they messed up there. I think also too, that's a place where you can fail if you're trying to win at Cannes. I mean, if the idea is amazing, like take Whopper Sacrifice, for example, like that was just an incredible idea that was now nobody else, well, someone else could have done it, but like you can't, for Facebook and for what was happening at the time, that was the perfect timing. Now the whatchamacallit, the case study video wasn't up to par, I think, of what you see nowadays, you know? So I'm always curious if there's any like case study videos that you thought that have sort of stood out, ones to mention and look at and like, this is how you do a case study video.
I think Jung von Matt in Germany invented the case study. I think they even had the German accent, you know, the problem, the idea, the results, you know. But I'm not trying to make fun of Germans, but a little bit. I worked in Germany, so I'm sort of allowed. But I think they developed it. I think David Droger perfected it. You know, the tap water project was probably the first real case video in the world. And I think Sweetie, Terre des Hommes, amazing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was the first case video that won a lion in the film category. The case video won a lion in film.
Yeah.
Believe it or not. We actually did the same, by the way.
I still remember seeing that one and going, because that was in 2014 when we won. Yeah. I still remember seeing that video and thinking to myself, it does, whatever category we are in with this thing, we are dead. It's over. Yeah,
exactly. I mean, talk about if you haven't seen Sweetie, the case video. It's literally one. It's a case video where you can actually talk about spoilers. When I saw that the first time, and the whole story changed in front of my eyes after a few seconds, I was like, you know what, this was amazing. This was storytelling. Mm-hmm. It was a case video, but
you only have 2 minutes to do it. So as everyone knows who doesn't know the case, you have 2 minutes to do your case study. So exactly. Change everybody's mind now. The best in the world. Go.
And you make up your mind after, you know, I've said this as a golden rule. I think it goes with whether you make, you know, documentaries or, you know, if you have even a wonderful story like Tiger King, if you don't get me after 30 seconds, or a minute or something like that, then you're screwed. You need to get me because there is so much content. There's so much waiting for me to watch. You know, in a case video, you know, you are dealing with advertising. You know where it's going. Somebody wants to sort of tell me about an idea they had. Mm-hmm. It's a very tough one, but you need to get me in those first few seconds. Forget about a build-up, a slow build-up, and then there's a like a reveal at the end. I mean, people will never get to the end, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Two minutes is not a long time if you feel you have a lot to say, but it's an eternity when you watch it. Believe me.
I still remember doing ours, and of course we were dealing with a very, very sad subject, and I think too at the time we were so drawn into the sadness, you know, at one point, so it was very emotional for all of us, because also we knew all these people and all these parents at that point, so you know it's you have to totally remove yourself as the third person and then think to yourself, okay, I've seen now 8,000 videos at 2 minutes a piece, and now I'm seeing this one. This isn't a normal environment. So it was funny, I still remember when we played it and Tor was watching it for the first time. I think we were about probably 20 or 30 seconds in. He's like, oh man, it's so much sadness. It's so sad. Like, okay, stop. Like, I know there's a problem with gun violence. Why am I so sad? Yeah. And it was a strange reaction, I think, for the rest of us, because we were sad, and it was a sad thing to be working on, you know. And then all of a sudden, we had that was the stop of like, oh, wait a minute, no, the people who are going to be watching this are, you know, jury demographic at this point are going to be, you know, on video number 17,000, and you need to get that stuff in the first 30 seconds, you know, hook me, you know, don't dwell on emotion, or unless there's a lot to give, like Sweetie, I think, is one of the examples where, you know, and then it did that turn, which again, we won't spoil it. Because someone's got to go watch it. I can't say anything here, but like, yeah, that's one of those ones where exactly. The first 30 seconds is prime, I think, to nail it.
No, but sadness. There's something about emotions when you watch, you know, basically what we're doing is no matter the media for the idea, this can be a digital idea, this can be a piece of long format content or an event or an experience or whatever it is, but you end with the film. And so it's like, you know, the mother of all ideas is basically that 2 minute video. They all need that video. They need it for the award shows, but they primarily need it for the PR, actually, for it to be shared and for anybody to understand that, what the hell are you talking about? Try to explain a media idea or an experience idea without a video. It's I would say it's literally impossible. So you need that film format, no matter what. I think when you start to use that film format as a film format, as a film, as a real film, you start to think about it as a piece of, I wouldn't say entertainment necessarily, because it's more in the documentary area for most ideas, but it needs to have that element, just like Tiger King or anything else that you want to watch, that you go like, I can't wait to see the end of this. I need to see what happened. I need to see how this unfolds. I need to see, you know, and that's pretty tough when you're dealing with advertising or creativity, because, you know, it's just not as interesting as Joe Exotic, of course.
But, of course, yes.
but, you know, wish it was, but it's not. But that's our job. I mean, we have to tell it as compelling as possible. So the minute you start to produce case videos, just the word case video, you already lost. You have to really go approach it like, okay, I have this idea and this execution and these results and all these things. I need to tell this story. How do I tell that? And if you start to default to some sort of formula that you have seen last year or the year before that, and or even if you try to replicate Sweetie or other famous case videos, you are lost. You need to present the jury with a new way of doing it, with new ways of rethinking the format of case videos. And I think if you really, this is tough, of course, because there is only that much you can do with that format. But I do think that it is very clear when you look at the biggest winners every year, they are breaking the format a little bit, they brought something new to the way they told their story, and not just documenting the greatness of their idea, but they gave justice to their idea by putting it in a film that was actually involving somehow to watch. A lot of the Lions that we have won at Grey was won because we did a very, very good job at telling the story. You know, I think the most famous example I can name is you have this amazing Volvo idea, Life Paint. You know, it's a relatively small idea, small batch of paint that you could put on your bike and yourself, actually, to make yourself light up in the evening so that people can see you. It's a safety thing for bicyclists. Amazing idea, but it existed in very small batch. But if you watch the film, the case video, it's like a film. It's like entertaining, and you want to watch more. And it's told by interesting people, and the visuals. Every single visual is a bliss for the eye to watch. Even the results are presented in an intriguing way, and the music is amazing. I think all of that helped that to become one of the biggest winners from Grey ever. You know, that this was a case video you can still pull out and say, okay, that's a fucking good case video.
Do you think? Definitely. That was one of the. That was an amazing case study. I think also the one for Volvo. Volvo's done a lot of really great case study videos. The one for the interception was good too. You know.
And remember, I mean, we put this is this sounds almost crazy to say this, but I think we put more effort into the case video than into actually executing the idea originally. I think the case video went 30 rounds or 40 rounds of re-editing of the most expensive people in the agency watching edit after edit to perfect it. It's still one of the most perfect case videos ever, down to the fact that we called this copywriter in Sweden that had a very, very cool Swedish accent in her English, perfect English. Josephine, and we said, can you please, you know, be the voiceover? She had never done voiceover before, and
right.
She nailed it. I mean, she, and that sort of cheekiness of you know, a woman's voice with this very sort of mischievous copy. I think Rob Lenoir was writing that. It just felt like. Yeah, in if a guy said that, it would be like, I don't know, it's maybe too much. But
right, come off as a jerk. But her saying it's very cheeky and like, yeah.
Cheeky, mischievous, Swedish accent. It becomes like, it's mischievous, but it's also a little innocent and it's very Swedish. And it just worked really, really well. And, I we put so much care into that. First of all, because we thought it was the biggest idea we've ever had. We said this is a great idea. It needs to be famous, but also because without all of those little details, it wouldn't have won anything. Because you're talking about a Twitter campaign and you're taking over live stuff going on during the Super Bowl. I mean, it was very complex, not very very entertaining as an idea.
Right.
But the video itself is super good and it's very entertaining, and I think. Still holds up to this day as one of the best case videos out there.
I think so too. That's definitely worth checking out. Do you think I know like a lot of some small businesses are listening to this, medium size, and then also of course young creatives too. For them, obviously putting that kind of expense into winning a Cannes Lion it's not achievable. You can't do it, but going after say smaller Cannes Lions, say in radio, or in, there are categories that you've seen that like are probably a bit easier to win. Not that you're going to go after and try and win one in those categories, but if you have a piece that's say in a direct marketing or something, do you notice any categories that might be easier to take home some hardware?
I think there is, of course there is.
Yeah.
I think especially new categories, every year Cannes will introduce a couple of new categories. You can definitely benefit from setting, going hard on those new categories. Like the year when Cannes launched the sustainable development goals category, the agencies that went after that had a better chance than the ones that just discovered, oh, there is such a category. Oh, I didn't know that. You know what I mean? It's like, of course, you can benefit from being first mover in a category. There is no easy category. I think it's hard in any category. But the competition, if you pick the right category, and I'm not just talking about the actual Lion category, I'm also talking about the subcategories. If you pick the right competition, the right subcategory, then you have a better chance. I mean, there are ideas out there that will clean up, and even if Cannes is doing a great job at avoiding that, it's just the fact that the best 10 ideas of the festival is going to win no matter what category they're put into. And if you don't have one of those ideas, most people don't, then you need to be smart about the way you enter. The number of categories you enter, the focus on picking the exact right one can make all the difference, there's a category in direct called retention, and people don't even know what it means. So most people don't enter.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I think that was kind of the funny thing for the titanium for a while too. Let's talk about that quickly. Like in the beginning, I think, and this is how I see it, so you tell me, you know, what you think here, is that titanium started as like, oh wow, I've never seen that before. And whether it was actually like, there were some of the idea, of course, the original one was BMW Films. So that really got all the media attention. That was big. Everyone saw it. Whereas then later on, in a few years after that, there were things that you'd never seen before, but I don't know if you'd actually even really seen it before, but you saw the potential of like, oh, wow, I didn't even know that was a thing. And then I think it's now evolved in the past, I don't know, 10, 8 years into, you know, best of show kind of, you know, do you think does that evolution kind of sound right?
Yeah, I think when Dan Wyden was judging film, jury president in film that year with the BMW, where technically they were not allowed to give those long format films any alliance because technically they were never broadcasted. They were the first sort of branded content, long format films to be entered in Cannes that were really good. And they obviously got their own category named after them and it became this titanium thing. You know, already there, you confused the world saying, okay, what is titanium? And then the year after, it was some Japanese barcode.
Yeah, I remember that. That
nobody understood anything of. And so I think there was a lot of confusion about it. I like that there is a confusion about what is a titanium. We all intuitively know that it is the most groundbreaking work, the work that sort of sets the completely new standards for the industry. And that's a hard one to win, of course. And it should be a hard one to win. It should be the most unpredictable winners. I actually get disappointed when I see, you know, winners from other categories also win in titanium. You know, I think that's probably a problem. You know, I think you should, if you win in titanium, you probably only win in titanium. Because it is beyond, you know, it doesn't really fit in any other normal category. You know, I think that should be the case. It's not anymore. It has, as you said, become best of show in a way. And you see, of course, last year it was Whopper Detour, and it was the best of show. You know, and it's the last award given on the festival, and it sort of sums it all up. But this is the biggest idea we saw, and it becomes that. But I, you know, I kind of prefer, you know, approaching titanium with this is the opportunity for the real rule breakers of the industry, the people that just think totally out of the box, without the cliches of what that means, but actually really, really does break all the
right
rules.
Let's just break some shit
and actually get away with it, you know. Yeah. Those guys should win the titanium. And of course you can argue, of course, the Whopper Detour does that. I mean, it is a rule breaking campaign.
Yeah.
So I don't have any issues with it winning, but you know, I do think that, you know, I love to see those titanium winners that I didn't see in any other festival or in any other list of Grand Prix or Gold Lions. I prefer it to be those special ideas, you know, that is just undefinable, you know.
Yeah, I remember with Crispin, you know, when I was there, there was a lot of breaking of platforms.
Exactly.
You know, like, so whether it was Whopper Sacrifice, you know, it overrode the defriend button, or, you know, and that blew up, obviously. And then there was also the Twitter campaign, 12 Force, and there was always just breaking of rules, you know, that seemed to be.
12 Force is an amazing example of a titanium. It is sort of, yeah. You would probably go like, what is this? I mean, where to put that? I mean, what is that? What is it? I mean, and I think that is how you should judge a titanium. You have to say, and I think that, you know, being honest, you know, being sort of true to the intentions from Dan Wyden when he saw those BMW films and said, I absolutely love them. They're probably the best films in the show, but we can't really give them any lions, so we have to build an award around them. That mm-hmm. That's how it should feel. I mean, you almost feel like you see something that is so provocative. And in the way that it treats the industry, you know, with radical thinking, you know, not just platform breaking, but also industry breaking in a way.
I remember one year they didn't even give one away because they didn't. No one thought that it hit that bar.
I know. I mean, you know, iconic campaigns like the best job in the world. When I saw that the first time, I can't even recall if it won a titanium or not. I hope it did. I know it won the Grand Prix in PR. I think that was the first time I saw a PR campaign.
Yeah.
That was creative. Like, I didn't even think you could do PR creatively, but then you could. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
And that's, for me, is a titanium. You know, you have a campaign that you have seen in your own local media. There's these crazy people in Australia that are offering a job. You literally just have to be a caretaker on this exotic island. They will pay you handsomely and check in on you every sort of, you know, 2 months, you know, to see how you're doing. And all they want to you know, take photos of your extremely nice life in this nice island in the middle of the coral reef. That was like, holy shit, you know, that was a mind-blowing campaign. And of course, people have tried to copy it ever since. But that is, for me, a titanium.
That's
a weird thought. It's like, holy, how can you even think like that? You
know? Yeah, exactly.
You're green with envy that somebody did that. But you also, you know, you also respect those people because they did something that was groundbreaking and set a completely new standard for how to think about PR. You know. And those kinds of campaigns.
Yeah. You have now, I mean, you've seen thousands of, you know, canned stuff. I mean, I've been watching it since I was 14, so I've seen a lot too, but I'm not studying it like you were for all those years. And also sort of your neck was on the line for knowing it all and making us the best. So this is a tough question for you. This is probably the hardest. I've asked a lot of people this question, but like, what do you think are your top three favorite can winning lines? It could be someone that we've never seen before. It could be, you know, it could be something like Dumb Ways to Die that won everything, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's like picking your babies. I mean, I think it's hard.
Yeah.
I mean, and I let's just go, you know, I won't pick anything I had anything to do with because that would be unfair.
Of course. No, you can't pick anything that it was gray or anything prior to that. No, it has to be. And also, too, this is, I want, like, so young people who are getting into the business, they can see what, you know, what you think the creme de la creme is of, like, of the entire festival. Because I want to make sure that when people listen to this podcast, they actually go back and watch these case studies. And so they understand what great and weird is.
I think, yeah. And you know, again, I mean, I could name 100, but you know, just top of mind, you know, when I saw the Honda Sound of Senna, and the reason why I bring this up, this is the recreation. This is so Japanese, and I remember actually showing it. I was judging an Asian award show, and I saw it before most people because it was entered, you know, into that festival way before Cannes. Mm-hmm. And I remember judging it, and I was like, do I hate this or do I fucking love it? I mean, this is like, I don't, it's like, it was so provocative in its thought that I had to show, I had, you know, I pulled Tor, I said, Tor, you have to see this. I don't even know what to say. I think this is mind blowing. I mean, I hate it, but I love it at the same time. And what these guys did was they, you know, apparently the fastest ever lap driven in a Formula One racing car was done by Ayrton Senna in a Honda. And of course, he later died and it was very tragic. But the people from Honda basically recreated that lap using sound and light. And this weird, very, you know, in a way, it was like a huge scale technology thing was witnessed by very few people. In this big racing track in Japan, and they made a film about it that is probably one of the most weird, talk about weird case videos, that I've ever seen, and but it was mind blowing, and it was, I think it won a Grand Prix, I think it won several actually, but it was
beat us. Yeah, that was the one that beat us. And I was like, yeah, that deserves to win that, because that was insane. I remember the lights, because it was at night. Everyone looked this one up. It was at night. It was, and they had these white lights that just went around the whole track, so you got to watch it. And then of course there was all these speakers, and so the sound and the roar of the engine. Oh, it was awesome.
And you watch that, and at no point it looks like any case video you ever saw in your life. It's not a fraction of marketing talk at all. There's no reason why we did this. There's no I don't even think they talk about results, anything like that. They just talked about what they did.
That's just amplifying awesome.
Exactly.
Like when you go to, you go to a fireworks display and they have like classical music with it, and it's like the best piece of music of all time. It's like the most fireworks. It was kind of felt like that. It was just this sort of spectacle, but then it all led back to, and it was the engine that did it. You know, it was so cool.
And then from a marketing perspective, of course, I mean, these guys succeeded in a way to get away with it's, you know, very, very boring brief that we all get. Product superiority, our technical heritage. We've done this for years, and we have extremely advanced motors or whatever product you're selling, and that always leads to shitty work, right? Because that becomes like these very boring voiceover TV commercials. But then they did something very, very different, talking about this sort of fact-based stuff, and it just worked really well. And I think that was for me extremely gratifying, also from not only as a creative idea, as a creative thought, but it was also executed at a scale that was still mind-blowing. I mean, to this day, it would be mind-blowing.
Mm-hmm. I think that's something for small, medium businesses to understand, too, is that the functional parts of a product isn't often what will be, talked about. If someone, you do something that is shareable content, however you want to put that, you could take one of the functional points and blow it up and amplify it and make it amazing, but it needs to be at the end of the day shareable for it to A, be sent to somebody else, double your media, but at the same time also hit you in the heart so that you remember it forever.
So
that's a good one.
That is a good one, and maybe not so commonly known as some of. No, this is not like, I mean, obviously, Fearless Girl, Dumb Ways to Die, these things are, of course, top of anybody's list. And I think they should be for a good reason. But if I am to give your listeners a direction on finding little nuggets here and there, then
yes,
then I would
2014
look up
Grand Prix Titanium.
Yes, it was a pretty awesome one. I think that one is amazing. I have, you mentioned that you talked about REI opt outside. I was in that jury, that titanium jury, with Hegarty as jury president when we gave the Grand Prix to REI. And even if I personally was losing that day because we had a runner up, it was like, okay. But I did feel good about it still, because REI's opt-out side campaign is another one of those where it all melts into one big thing. It's a campaign driven by a true belief from a company that they're not seeking popularity. They're not seeking an easy way out. This is probably one of the most expensive campaigns ever done, because you basically, you don't have any revenue on the biggest day of retail in the US. And you make a point about what kind of company you are and what you believe in. I still have that as an extraordinary good idea. It's extremely well told. It's got so many components. It's a true 360 campaign, very holistic in its approach. It's driven by PR. It's driven by being relevant in the culture. It's something that is relevant in the now, which I talked about before. You know, like this is relevant as a comment to something that has gone totally crazy in society, the consumerism, and we all spend too much time on our mobile phones buying shit we don't really need, while there is a beautiful world outside. And they make a great point about that. I think that is one of my absolute favorite campaigns ever, and one of the biggest thoughts I've ever seen.
So also yeah. Episode 4 of How to Kill a Lion podcast, a little plug there.
Yeah, I think you should go and listen to how they did that, because I know it was a very, very, you know, you can't really tell, was it an idea that came from the client or the agency or who did what, but I think that's the beauty of that idea. It takes all those people. It all comes together. You know, you can't say, oh, the agency had an idea, they pitched it to the client, they bought it. No, this is a true collaboration. And I think that is what great ideas are most of the time. They are collaborations between creative people, business people, you know, the people that run their companies, coming together as one team. And I think REI is a beautiful example of that. One of my absolute favorite.
Awesome. Definitely. All right. You got one more though. So that's going to be, you got one more baby. That's a tough one. No, but I threw out two honey. So you got like, yeah.
I mean, you know, there is very, very few campaigns that, you know, will make you go like, holy fuck, I want to buy this product. Where can I buy this? Even if you're not feeling like this is not a category for me, I'm not one of those people. You still want to buy this product. And when I was, you know, the first time I was in a Cannes jury, we were judging film. And again, there are breaking points in time where things change, where you go from one way of thinking about film to a completely different way of thinking about film. And that happened that year. And it happened because we were judging two amazing pieces of film. We had The Drumming Gorilla, from Cadbury, mm-hmm. which is, I would still, you probably can still teach classes in art school about what the hell is this? know, why is a gorilla playing the drums with, you know,
Phil Collins, of all things too, like
for a chocolate. I mean,
I'm just laughing.
What is going on? So that was one, but that was almost given, because that was this, you know, that was the one going into the competition. Everybody said, "Oh, that's legendary." I mean, who can ever do something bigger than that? I mean, that's The Drumming Gorilla, you know. But I do want to point people's attention to the other campaign, because that was the year where there was two Grand Prix in film, and it was one of the longest jury sessions I've ever been in, because we were not supposed to give two Grand Prix. But the other one is Halo 3 for, you know, this was the this Xbox campaign, Halo 3, mm-hmm. where they create this diorama, you know, depicting an actual scene from, you know, we're talking gaming now, you know, gaming, Halo. And I'm not a big fan of Halo at all. And I'm not even a big gamer at all.
I lost a lot of hours to Halo. Just saying. Oh, yeah.
I went out and bought that game because of that. Okay?
Yeah.
And you know, the way they told that story, not with one film, but with a complete series of film, they made this game feel important and as something that was real. And something that I absolutely needed to be part of, instead of showing the usual in-game footage, you know, showing off how advanced the 3D technology is and all that stuff, they told a story about a war that had happened 50 years earlier, and as seen by the veterans that participated in that war, they were talking about, just like any other war, they were talking about the memories they had from that war and the violence they saw and all the, you know, the heroism that came from Sergeant Major, whatever he's called, you know, mm-hmm. And they created this diorama that was supposed to be on that exhibition in this museum in this future world, that depicted a very important battle scene. Not in-game footage, but an actual diorama with a degree of the detail. And basically, the film is a walk through that diorama with classical music on it. And you go like, mm-hmm. What the hell is going on here? I'm watching a diorama with classical music on it, and it's for a game. You know, it was just an endless amount of storytelling and footage that just told this beautiful story about a game that made you just want to go like, I need to understand this world. They sold me a world that I wanted to explore. I wanted to be part of. That was a radical different approach to using film. And again, opened my eyes to rethinking that format. And that's why it's also one of my favorites, ever. You know, so I would put that in there as well. And I think it got forgotten a little bit by time because, you know, things happen. But, you know, for your listeners, go watch Halo 3. That's an amazing piece of film storytelling for a game, and definitely worth checking out.
Awesome. So I know I've had you for some time here, so I will let you get back to your awesomeness in Scandinavia right now. So, but I got one more question before you leave. So we know, of course, that, you know, rosé is plentiful and can. That's not the reason to go, but it often quenches the thirst and helps the creativity, or at least the camaraderie flow. I don't know if it really helps creativity at the end of the day, personally. But my question is, after the festival's over, the week's done, you're at a dinner party right now, and someone cracks a bottle of rosé, do you A, recoil in fear, B, politely drink it and smile through your teeth, or do you grab it with two hands and chug it because that's pretty much the only thing you've known for the past week?
I'm telling you, I drink this shit one time a year.
The same way.
And I swear to God, after a week of that, you are done. I mean, you're done.
I can't look at it. It's horrifying.
No, it's horrifying. The way it does something inside your mouth that is, I can't even explain. After a few glasses, it becomes very unpleasant, extremely unpleasant. And the hangover is unpleasant. It's usually really bad quality, at an extremely high price. No, I hate the sight of it. I mean, I can't. I mean, it's the one thing going in there. I mean, you know, Cannes being canceled this year, that's one of the most positive things about Cannes being canceled, is that I don't have to go through that. But it's one of the things that I dread the most going in there when we go to Cannes, having to drink that stuff. I mean, it's the worst part of Cannes, the worst part of everything. You know, I can live with the, you know, all the horrible people. I can live with the politics. I can live with people trying to sell themselves and their products and stuff to me, getting a job or whatever it is they want to achieve. I can live with that, okay? But I cannot live with the rosé. It's horrible. It's horrible. Don't go. Don't ever go.
Per Pedersen, or as I like to call him, Mr. Can. Thanks so much for hanging out with me, man. I missed you obviously for a while. I haven't seen you in a while, but this is as always a lot of fun.
All right, man. Brought back a lot of memories.
Give special thanks to the musical nerds over at Storefront Music in New York City for helping me with the tracks and some of the sound design here. Also, big thanks to my good friend Alan Peck out of Dallas, Texas.
You're welcome, and I love you.
Alan's been the promo voice of the Ellen DeGeneres Show for a long time now, and he's on a ton of other TV shows, and I think he's done about 1,000 commercials. Finally, a big shout out to all the people I've worked with over the years, both from the greatest advertising agencies on the planet to the now defunct radio station in small town Canada that I worked at back in 1997. Each and every one of you taught me something along the way that has led to this.